there's a lot of waste that goes out the outfall pipes, right? So we've been working on this process for quite some time, knowing that the future is 100% capture.
Trident Seafoods plans a state-of-the-art processing plant in Unalaska that will be the largest in North America. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 27th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, Anchorage sees historic growth in low-income housing units.
The Trust will have added over 270 new affordable housing units across three properties in just the last 9 months.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Dina Bishop has been named Commissioner of the State Department of Education and Early Development. The state school board voted unanimously to approve Bishop yesterday. Bishop has over three decades of education experience in Alaska and most recently worked as a special assistant to Governor Mike Dunleavy on education issues. She was Anchorage School District's superintendent for 6 years and also previously served as superintendent of the Mat-Su School District. Bishop will officially take over for Acting Commissioner Heidi Teschner on August 9th. Teschner has been in the role since June of last year when then-Commissioner Michael Johnson resigned. Meanwhile, yesterday was another busy day for firefighters in the interior as more lightning-caused wildfires were detected. Many of the new blazes are in remote locations and being allowed to burn, but several are being fought. Blazes southwest of Allakaket and off the Stees and Elliott highways are being worked by the Alaska Fire Service, and the State Division of Forestry and Fire Protection is attending to several others, including a new lightning-caused fire along the Teklanika River southwest of Nenana. State Fire Information Officer Sam Harrell says there are cabins along the river corridor.
And then, of course, the Parks Highway on the other side, Anderson Clear, and the Space Force radar station.
Harrell says the Teklanika fire was hit hard from the air with water and retardant drops late yesterday, but it will need more attention due to area forest conditions.
Dense, packed stands of black spruce and aerial resources won't do that alone. We need to get crews in there, and crews are mobilizing and headed that way.
Harrell says recent hot weather has dried out trees and surface vegetation, making them susceptible to burning when hit by lightning, but the lingering effects of wet early summer weather are so far slowing fire spread.
Those lower layers of duff are just too damp to carry a fire and give it the energy to grow.
Harrell says another round of thunderstorms started additional wildfires last night, continuing a three-day trend that's drawing down in state resources.
We have sent some resources to Canada to help. We've sent some resources to the northwest areas to help, and we might need to be recalling some of those.
There were over 30,000 lightning strikes in Alaska Monday through Wednesday, and 80 new wildfires bumped the number of acres burned from about 1,500 to nearly 11,000. Alaska exports billions of dollars of seafood each year, and most of that fish and crab are caught in the Aleutian Islands, Bering Sea region. Right smack dab in the middle of that area sits the largest seafood processing plant in North America. Now, the owner, Trident Seafoods, is building an even larger plant right next door in Unalaska. But as KUCB's Theo Greenlee reports, that's no easy task.
It doesn't matter where you are in the world. If you order a McDonald's Filet-O-Fish sandwich, there's a pretty good chance that fish came from the Aleutian Islands. It's the nation's largest fishing grounds for Alaska pollock. That's the whitefish most commonly found in fish sticks, imitation crab meat, and fish sandwiches from just about every fast food company in the world. Trident Seafoods currently operates the largest fish processing plant in North America in the small community of Accutan, just one island over from Unalaska. But the brutal conditions of the Aleutians can wreak havoc on, well, just about everything. Stephanie Moreland, a spokesperson for the seafood company, says the plant is no exception.
We're really facing decades of wear from weather, from saltwater and production. Really need to replace the aging infrastructure that we rely on there.
Trident has decided to do that by building a new plant in Unalaska. She says it didn't make sense to renovate the Accutane plant.
We can't be operating a plant and making the kinds of changes and improvements that we needed to within the facility that we're running currently in Accutane. So we spent quite a bit of time designing what the needs were for a facility. We then had opportunity that was somewhat unexpected.
That unexpected opportunity was a property that became available in Unalaska's Captain's Bay, about 15 acres of tidelands on a protected bay with plenty of space for a dock. They leased it in 2022 and set out to build a facility they call Next Generation. Jared Brand is the project's site manager. He says they're trying to build the most efficient facility possible, from using renewable energy to implementing 100% protein capture. That doesn't just mean using the whole fish from fillets to roe. They already do that. It means being so efficient that not a scrap is left to pump out to sea.
There's a lot of waste that goes out the outfall pipes, right? So we've been working on this process for quite some time, knowing that, you know, the future is 100% capture and putting it into a sellable product. And it also makes the best use of the resource.
But how do you build a state-of-the-art plant on a remote island in the middle of nowhere? They don't just have to design the plant. They also have to work with the city to figure out the required infrastructure. How will the plant generate power? What about plumbing, water, roads? It's a challenge. Just ask Unalaska City Manager Bill Homka.
We have diced this thing like a Rubik's Cube, except it's almost like a Rubik's rectangle, just to kind of make it stranger. And you see all the parts, but every time you look at it, you twist one here, you twist one there, and see how it works.
Electricity happens to be today's puzzle. The city of Unalaska is the community's primary power provider. But they don't produce enough energy for the plant. Many processing facilities produce their own energy, usually a mixture of diesel and fish oil. But Trident says it wants to avoid power production. They'd much rather buy it. But Unalaska has another possible power source just bubbling with potential, the McCushion Geothermal Project. The community has been trying to tap nearby McCushion Volcano for geothermal energy for decades. After tons of false starts, a contractor is now actually working on the project. Homka says it's not guaranteed, but it could work.
So it's an interesting place to be out in the middle of rural Alaska and having all this development. It's wonderful if it all syncs up timing-wise between when Trident would be online and when geothermal would be ready. So there's just timing is of an amazing essence.
The Trident crew is currently building bunkhouses, and the geothermal crew is building an access road. Both projects say they plan to be online in 2027. In Unalaska, I'm Theo Greenlee.
The remains of three state employees killed in a helicopter crash a week ago are being returned to their families in Fairbanks today. Division of Geological and Geophysical Survey team members Ronnie Danin, Justin German, and Tori Moore died July 20th when a chartered helicopter they were being transported in for field work on the North Slope crashed. Their remains were sent to the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage for autopsy, and according to a Department of Natural Resources release, are today being flown to Fairbanks, where their families and state honor details will transport them in vehicle processions to local funeral homes. The helicopter's pilot, Tony Higdon of North Pole, was also killed in the crash. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, researchers in Southeast Alaska study the fecal plume of whales and how it supports smaller marine life.
It smells awful. It smells like fishy poop. I mean, it is fishy poop, so.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What gives you strength? Strength comes from teaching the Alaskan way of life. Getting wood, fishing, hunting, helping people in the community, and being an example for the next generation. If you have forgotten your strength, remember, there's hope, there's joy, there's love, there's peace everywhere. Share what gives you strength at recoveralaska.org/share your strength. This message sponsored by Recover Alaska.
Another Anchorage hotel converted into low-income housing is set to come online this fall. The renovation of the former Barrett Inn is the latest move in a public-private partnership between the city government and community leaders to stand up housing in an effort to address homelessness. Jason Bockenstedt is executive director of the Anchorage Affordable Housing and Land Trust. At a press conference at the Barrett Inn today in Spinard, Bockenstedt said it's the third hotel converted into housing.
Upon completing the renovation of this property, the trust will have added over 270 new affordable housing units across three properties in just the last 9 months.
Homelessness advocates say the city would need to build more than 2,000 housing units to effectively end homelessness in Anchorage. The Barrett Inn will have 96 permanent housing units, which range in size from single occupancy to one- and two-bedroom apartments. Bockenstedt says he anticipates people starting to move in by September. He says the goal is to serve low-income residents and those at poverty level. Monthly rent will range from $840 to $1,150 per unit, including utilities, but Bockenstedt says he expects many residents will have housing vouchers through Social Security, the VA, and other avenues.
I would guess here there's probably going to be upwards of 70% that have a voucher that comes with them, and that will be what kind of pays for their rent.
Other recent hotel conversions include the former Guest House and Lakeshore Inn, which both became low-income housing, plus the former Sockeye Inn now serves as a shelter for homeless people with complex needs. Meanwhile, Anchorage officials took two big steps forward Tuesday towards rebuilding the aging and vulnerable cargo lifeline almost the entire state relies on. The Anchorage Assembly approved key design decisions outlining how to rebuild two cargo terminals at the city-owned Port of Alaska with an eye on current and future needs. The Assembly also approved new user fees that port officials intend to leverage for big state and federal grants to pay for the project. Assembly Chair Chris Constant called modernizing the port a generational project and highlighted Tuesday's action as a key point in breaking the logjam. The massive port project has been bogged down for years in political, legal, and technical processes.
We decided tonight Terminal 1 design is going forward, and Terminal 2, we're going to have two options to look at with an analysis of the user base, and we have a vehicle to finance the project. All of that in one night is a pretty damn good deal.
The port is being designed to last 75 years and to stand up to earthquakes. The Assembly's action puts this phase on a path for construction to begin in 2025. Firm cost estimates aren't available, but the entire project is likely to cost more than $1 billion. Meg Zalatel chairs the Assembly committee that shepherded this chunk of the project forward. She says Tuesday's action will lead to more design work in 2024 and a menu of options with cost estimates for various components, ranging from port essentials to individual users' wants. She says when the cargo terminals are ready to build,
we can assure the public that we have thoroughly looked at the options, that we are picking options that allow the Port of Alaska to function as the Port of Alaska is intended to, and that we have a good plan of finance in place that doesn't place the cost considerably on consumers.
An earlier phase of the port modernization project to replace the petroleum and cement terminal was completed last fall. The first ships used the new $219 million facility in May. Despite major cost increases, Department of Transportation officials say the Cooper Landing Bypass Project is set to open in 2027 as originally scheduled. But to get there, DOT will need to seek alternative sources of funding and readjust the work schedule over the next 4 years. KDLL's Riley Board reports.
Officially, the Sterling Highway Milepost 45-60 project, the Cooper Landing Bypass is a decades-old plan to divert traffic around Cooper Landing by creating a highway bypass through the mountains north of the town. It includes miles of new highway, plus a bridge over Juneau Creek Canyon that will be the longest single-span bridge in the state and highest crossing when complete. In June, the project's manager expressed concerns about its funding, pointing to a lack of money in the state legislative budget and suggesting the completion date could be delayed. Shannon McCarthy, a spokesperson for DOT, says dramatically rising costs have caused concerns about funding the project, but are currently not expected to delay the opening of the road. McCarthy says the project was originally estimated to be a $350 million endeavor in 2018. By 2021, that number was closer to $500 million. By 2022, it had risen to almost $700 million, and a new assessment this year shows the current cost to be $840 million, almost 2.5 times the original price tag. McCarthy says DOT is now turning to outside sources to make up those increases.
When Congress passed the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, they created a number of competitive grant opportunities. And one of them is called the Mega Program. And this is the one that supports these really large, complex projects that are difficult to fund in other ways. So it's kind of like tailor-made for a Cooper Landing Bypass project.
She says the department plans to apply for that and other grants. It's also reorganizing the schedule for the project to work around those cost issues by pushing one leg of the project scheduled for next year.
What we would do is we're really aiming to build that final leg in 2027, and that gives us a little bit of time to pursue that funding that's outside of the state's annual allocation.
The plan for the next year was to begin work on the bridge, as well as that other part of the project. But McCarthy says now, with rising costs, it's not realistic to work concurrently on those parts of the bypass. Together, their costs would have been roughly equivalent to DOT's yearly budget for the whole state. So moving forward on that work would cause delays across Alaska.
Because of the cost increases, we are going to have to think about spreading the phases out a little bit more than we originally had wanted, but that it is moving forward, and that we're going to really pursue this alternate funding in hopes of securing that last bit that we need and still not impact other projects statewide.
She says DOT attributes the cost increase to inflation, but says the agency is also going to take another look at the latest financial analysis to make sure it's a reasonable estimation.
So we'll have to take a look at that and see, just confirm, are we doing this the right way? Have we added something in that we don't need to?
Information about the new cost estimates and timeline are included in the department's new statewide transportation infrastructure program, a 4-year spending plan for the allotment of federal money in state highway projects. The plan is currently in draft form and is open for public comment through September 3rd. McCarthy says design work is wrapping up on the bridge this summer, and construction should begin in 2024. In Kenai, I'm Riley Board.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com. Alaska needs more quality, licensed childcare providers. If you are interested in starting a childcare business, connect with threadalaska.org for support and guidance. There are several resources to get licensed and launched in Alaska. A licensed facility opens doors and opportunities for the business owner and creates a safer, more engaged place for children. You can make a lasting difference in the lives of children and their families. This message sponsored by Thread.
The internet and mass marketing campaigns just declared this past weekend an event, Barbenheimer. It was the hottest box office selling weekend since before the pandemic for the motion picture industry, and not the result of one hot hit, but of an unlikely movie duo, a reimagining of the iconic blonde doll Barbie and a broody Christopher Nolan film about the creation of the atomic bomb. Hot pink became trendy again, people debated which movie to see first, and made sure to have tickets pre-purchased. The day before the premiere, Bethel's Civic Theater announced they would be showing Barbie on the opening weekend. Oppenheimer will be coming when freight cargo arrives. KYUK's Sunny Bean was at the first showing.
In Bethel, movie tickets are only sold at the door. 10 minutes before the first viewing of Barbie, 13 customers stood in line. For many viewers, part of the Barbie-going experience was choosing an outfit and joining the movie-going mania. In Bethel, nobody wore the characteristic hot pink. Customers waited quietly for tickets and popcorn. Still, the theater knew the town was keen.
On Facebook, this movie got a lot of responses. So we saw a lot of likes, people tagging other people and saying, hey, we should go at this time or this day.
That's Natalie Mikesaw, the director of secondary education for the school district. Today, she's manning the cash register and concessions because the movie theater is at the school. And as a school official, she stepped in while the theater manager is on bereavement leave.
We're pretty limited, especially during the school year when the building is actually a school.
It's the town's only theater, and during the year, it's been acting as an elementary school after the local immersion school burned down. The theater has two screens, which show two movies over the weekends. Mikesaw explained that getting movies upon release isn't something residents assume. Sometimes, the theater has had to cancel at the last minute when shipments haven't arrived. Getting movies to the screen relies on getting both a hard copy of the film and a digital key before showtime.
All of the companies are located downstate, and so they ship things two-day air, and they think, hey, it's two-day air, it won't be a problem to get to you. And we've told them many, many times two-day air doesn't mean anything to us, but they just, it's big name, you know, it's Paramount, it's Universal, it's the big companies downstate that distribute the movies, and they do it on their schedule, not ours.
They had ordered both movies, but were still unsure what the Barbenheimer phenomenon would mean for them.
So it was kind of rushed, and we weren't sure that the movie would come in time. With the runway work that they're doing at the airport, a lot of cargo keeps getting delayed, and if we don't get the movie in time to run it and, they call it digest it, on the theater servers, then we can't play them in time.
Many had played with Barbies themselves. Fans like Ariel Andrew and Charlie Myers were happy to get to see the colorful feminist comedy.
I waited, what, 31 years? Growing I see my friends mm-hmm. playing Barbies. Mm-hmm. Always wished we had a movie to watch. Barbies and finally came up. Mm-hmm. I love the Kens.
The Kens and One Allen.
I had a weird Barbie. I think we all had a weird Barbie. We all had a weird Barbie.
Others were following the buzz.
Because I bought Mattel's stock on the hype, and I'm hoping the stock goes up. So I'm contributing to my own stock increase by going to the movie.
Oh, the granddaughter wanted to watch Barbie.
Nobody seemed too bothered that Oppenheimer wasn't on just yet. They were hoping it would be on for this upcoming weekend, but the schedule was just released with Barbie and Mission Impossible again. While other theaters bolstered sales by having Barbie and Oppenheimer as a pair, they say in Bethel it might be better this way.
That way people don't have to make a decision between the two in one weekend. Going to the movies is a special treat for a lot of families.
People in Bethel are used to it.
Oh, we'll get it. If we don't get it, I'll see Oppenheimer sometime, when it comes on stream.
But they were happy to be part of the Barbie buzz. In Bethel, I'm Sunny Bean.
Humpback whales could be growing their own food supply and fighting climate change in a very unusual way through their poop. KFSK's Thomas Copeland has more on research happening this summer into the whale pump hypothesis.
The first time Dana Block ever saw a whale, she was in Provincetown, Massachusetts, with her grandfather.
I would usually fall asleep on the whale watches, I think, because it was a long boat ride out there. It was sunny and rocking. And when I was about 7, I was like, I'm going to stay awake and I'm going to see all the whales and spot them first.
And it was humpbacks in particular that Block fell in love with.
They're so kind of like lumpy, bumpy and gangly and have this ridiculous shape. They're mysterious and under the water. Like there's just these giant mammals like blobbing around doing really cool stuff.
2 decades later, Block has crossed the continent to study some of that cool stuff going on under the waves as part of a postgraduate degree at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. She's looking into a process called the whale pump hypothesis. Block says it has 4 steps.
Step 1 is the whale is feeding on nutrient-rich prey.
And that could be krill, herring, maybe juvenile salmon or sand lance.
Step 2 is the whales return to the surface and they produce a fecal plume in the surface water.
Okay, but what is fecal plume in like normal language?
A fecal plume is a giant cloud of whale poop.
Block says the best way to spot the whale poop is from a drone.
And I have a picture here that you can see. It's like a red cloud that's kind of coming from underneath the whale's tail, and it usually comes as the whale dives.
But enough of what the poop looks like. It's what the poop contains that really matters.
Step three, the material in the whale poop is very rich in nutrients. In Southeast Alaska, we're mostly interested in phosphorus and nitrogen.
And finally comes step four.
Phytoplankton are using the nutrients to grow and reproduce.
So there you have it, the four steps in the whale pump hypothesis in Southeast Alaska. But wait, why should we care about phytoplankton? Well, Block says there are two reasons why. The first is that phytoplankton are the base of the ocean food chain. Everything else relies on it, including the fish that whales eat. And that's why Dana says humpbacks could be like gardeners of the sea.
It's like they're fertilizing the area where their food may be growing. And in that sense, the whales may be kind of in less competition with the fisheries or with other ocean needs than we sometimes think.
And the second reason we should care about phytoplankton is maybe even more important.
They're primary producers that are responsible for about 50% of the oxygen in the air. So they're responsible for every other breath you take.
50% of the oxygen produced in the world is from phytoplankton? What?
Yeah. Some estimates are higher, but that's a ballpark estimate.
I thought trees produced all the oxygen.
Trees produce a lot of the oxygen, but the oceans are giant and cover most of the earth.
Plus, when phytoplankton die, they sink to the bottom of the ocean, storing all that carbon far away from the surface. Now, superhero phytoplankton like this sound really cool, but Block's job is a little less glamorous. She works with the Alaska Whale Foundation out of Warm Springs Bay to collect the data she needs.
Whale's up, go down.
She has a video of herself hanging off the side of a boat with a white net in her hand.
Perfect.
When the drone pilot says, like, okay, go ahead, I drop a small phytoplankton net into the water and just run it through the fecal plume. I pull it out and transfer that into a bottle and put it in the freezer next to our frozen berries.
What does it smell like?
It smells awful. It smells like fishy poop. I mean, it is fishy poop, so.
Block says there's lots more work to be done in the future. But when she's out on the water, she's thinking back to her grandfather's boat in Massachusetts.
If I told my 7-year-old self, I wouldn't have believed myself then because it's just like, that's way too cool.
Even if it involves scooping up whale poo?
Yeah, the whale poo I don't think I would have anticipated.
Block will continue her research until the spring of 2024. So there's plenty of time for her to fully digest all the data she collects this summer. In Petersburg, I'm Thomas Copeland.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Theo Greenlee in Unalaska, Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Riley Board in Kenai, Sunny Bean in Bethel, and Thomas Copeland in Petersburg. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. We're glad to have you tuning in, and we'd love to welcome you as a member. Make a donation to this station and be a part of the public media family. Thank you. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.